Morning, let's all be seated. So this is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, September 12, 2019. We are hearing oral arguments at the Olmsted County Government Center in Rochester. Very grateful to be here today. And we have a total of six matters on our calendar. We've completed hearing three of them and we're ready for the last three. And I see counselors sitting at table. So I'll proceed to call the fourth matter on our calendar, set for 11:30. It's A18-2105, State of Minnesota versus Jason Elliott Peterson. And I see a counselor here and ready, so I'll just make a few remarks, but it's probably things you already know. And in particular, I think with regard to Mr. Did you say Swihart?
Swihart.
So your second time up, you're going to be up three times before we're done today. but what all I want to do is underscore that we're looking forward to the conversation. Please keep an eye on the clock because it does tend to go quickly. And then, take whatever time you need to gather your materials and then start your argument. So, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Jason Peterson. Mr. Peterson was convicted of two counts of stalking by telephone. I raised four issues on appeal. Today, I'd like to address two of those issues. First, the trial court's failure to obtain a waiver before allowing Mr. Peterson to represent himself at trial. And second, the overbreadth challenge to the stalking by phone statute. Mr. Peterson did not waive his right to counsel in writing, on the record, or by his conduct. He was initially represented by private counsel, but informed the court that he was going to fire his attorney and he planned to hire a different one. Mr. Peterson appeared next without counsel, and the court did not conduct a waiver. The court asked a single question. You're representing yourself? It asked that same question at the settlement conference and at trial, and each time Mr. Peterson answered yes. The court never conducted a colloquy to ensure a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. To ensure a criminal defendant's right to counsel is protected, the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure require that the court conduct an inquiry before allowing a defendant to proceed pro se. The trial court must not accept the waiver unless the court is satisfied that it is voluntary and that it is made with the defendant's full knowledge and understanding of his rights.
And I agree with you, there is no such waiver here. That doesn't end the analysis, though, does it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, I mean, can't we also look to the fact that your client attended, I think, three hearings over an eight-month period with counsel, that your client also went through a Rule 20 evaluation process when, you know, how things happen at trial and the nature of the charges and things were discussed and the expert concluded that, in fact, your client understood and appreciated all of those things. Isn't that relevant to our to the district court's permitting your client to represent himself without getting an express waiver?
Yes, Your Honor, those things are relevant. If there is no waiver, this court does consider the totality of the circumstances, and that includes the defendant's background, their conduct, and their experience. But nothing in this record suggests that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, or intelligent. There is nothing in the record to suggest that counsel or the court discussed any of these things with Mr. Peterson.
I will start from the premise that you do, which is that there is clearly no express waiver or colloquy mm-hmm. here. So we are in, as you noted, we're in the situation of looking at the totality of the circumstances. It seems to me that the circumstances, in addition to what's already been mentioned, have to include that there was a discussion because Mr. Peterson is the one who initiated the firing of his counsel and did so in court, you know, sought that permission to for the counsel to withdraw and indicated that he planned to substitute counsel and that this happened over several hearings. Now, no actual substitution ever took place, but it seems that there is that part of the circumstances. Again, I'm not excusing the court's district court's failure to follow the rules and the engage in the colloquy that we normally would see, but I'd like to hear your response in terms of how does that factor in? Because we do have several cases in Minnesota that look very expansively at the facts and circumstances that led to this issue, which is, was the waiver knowing, voluntary, intelligent?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Peterson did say in open court that he intended to fire his attorney and hire a different one. I actually think that works in his favor, though, in this case. The fact that he was intending to hire another attorney suggests that his attorney, who was representing him, would have had no reason whatsoever to discuss the risks or the pitfalls of proceeding pro se. So there would have been, if there's no intention stated to go pro se, there would have been no reason to have that discussion. The fact that he said in open court that he wished to fire his attorney, again, that also works in his favor. That would have been an opportunity for the court to discuss the fact that that there are risks involved, and also to educate him about what his responsibilities would be, and that never happened. Judge Borkman, you mentioned the fact that he had the Rule 20 evaluation. And it's important to note that a Rule 20 evaluation does not assess whether someone is competent to represent themselves or whether they understand everything that is entailed in representing themselves. The question during the Rule 20 evaluation is whether he is competent to assist in his defense, whether he is competent to consult with an attorney. It does not suggest that he understands everything that is entailed in subpoenaing witnesses, for example, or cross-examining witnesses, or his obligations under the rules of discovery.
And I agree with all of that. I mean, but I also think, and I wasn't there, and I know that the record doesn't always reflect, you know, exactly what was happening in the courtroom. But as I recall, the last time your client appeared in court with an attorney, the attorney was just wanting to enter a not guilty plea on his behalf, and your client didn't even want him to do that. I mean, isn't there some evidence in this record that your client really did want to represent himself and didn't need any, you know, that he was very voluntary because he didn't want to follow his lawyer's lead, even to the extent of entering a plea that was in his favor, a plea of not guilty?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that that really shows that he did not understand what was going on. He didn't even understand what a not guilty plea was. The Supreme Court in Camacho discussed, in that case, the defendant had very low IQ, and the court was concerned enough to order a Rule 20 evaluation like the court was in this case. And in Camacho, the court underscored the fact that if there are questions about competency or if they're close to being incompetent, that makes it all the more necessary to have a thorough waiver. In Camacho, the waiver was okay, but the court went through in detail about the fact that it was a very thorough, detailed waiver, and that's the only reason it was acceptable in that case. In this case, we have a client who is exhibiting the signs of being incompetent. The court is concerned enough to request a competency hearing or a competency evaluation and then doesn't take the time to ensure that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. There's nothing in this record to really suggest that Mr. Peterson understood the legal system very well. While he did have other convictions, there's nothing to indicate that he had other trials. And he clearly didn't understand. He didn't understand the rules of discovery. He didn't get a witness list in, so he was barred from calling the witnesses that he wished to call. And in fact, he says, you know, before trial begins, before the jury is called in, there was some discussion, and Mr. Peterson says, I really just don't know what to do here. I don't know where to go. And the court didn't take any of those opportunities to ensure that the waiver was knowing, voluntary, or intelligent. Mr. Peterson did not waive his right to counsel, and the record does not support a finding that he knowingly, intelligently, or voluntarily waived his right to counsel. I'd also point this court to the case of Hawanchuk, where this court said that because the court failed to inquire, it's impossible to determine on appeal whether the waiver was knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. And the same situation exists here.
So your opposing counsel makes the argument that, in fact, Mr. Peterson forfeited his right due to dilatory behavior because he indicated repeatedly to the district court that he was going to substitute counsel, and he didn't do it.
He only indicated once that he was going to substitute counsel. And then he appeared twice after that, and in both of those times, again, the court just asked the single question, you're representing yourself, and Mr. Peterson responded yes. I would point this court to the Jones case that's cited in both briefs. Jones makes clear that forfeiture is reserved for cases of extreme misconduct when other efforts to remedy the situation have failed. In this case, there was no extreme misconduct. I would agree that Mr. Peterson did tend to get into irrelevant details at the hearings. But again, that is a sign that he really did not know what was going on here and makes it all the more necessary to conduct the colloquy. So for all of those reasons, Mr. Peterson's waiver was not valid. He did not waive his right, and he did not waive it by forfeiture. Moving on to the next issue, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in the welfare of AJB makes it clear that the stalking by telephone statute is facially overbroad. In Mr. Peterson's principal brief, we conceded that the court's decision in Hall was controlling on the issue of whether the stalking statute was overbroad. After filing, however, the Minnesota Supreme Court decided the welfare of AJB and held the stalking by mail subdivision was overbroad on its face. And this issue is addressed in depth in the reply brief that I filed. The Minnesota Supreme Court was concerned that subdivision 1, which contains the mens rea element for all of the stalking statutes, was too broad. The statute provides that the defendant knows or has reason to know that the communication would, under the circumstances, cause the victim to feel frightened, oppressed, persecuted, or intimidated. In this case, the Supreme Court found that mens rea element was overbroad for several reasons. First, the know or reason to know language that punishes speech even under circumstances where the defendant does not intend or even know that his communication would frighten or oppress or persecute. Second, the court was concerned about the under the circumstances language because that dictated what the actor should have known at the time the communication was made. And third, the list of the victim's potential reactions was expansive and used as a subjective rather than an objectively reasonable standard. The stalking by telephone subdivision is unconstitutionally overbroad for the same reasons as the stalking by mail subdivision. Like the stalking by mail subdivision, stalking by telephone is closely tethered to expressive activity. And significantly, the mens rea and the victim's potential reactions are the same for both subdivisions. Subdivision 1 applies to both subdivisions 6 and 4. Because the court in Welfare of AJB found the stalking statute was overbroad on its face due to the language in Subdivision 1, which applies to both subdivisions, Mr. Peterson's stalking convictions must be reversed.
So, counsel, if we did agree with you that there was not a valid waiver of counsel and reversed and remanded, wouldn't it be better to, if we did that, I'm not saying we will, then have the district court address this constitutionality issue in a way that it's fully briefed from the beginning instead of suddenly the case comes down, you're addressing it in your reply, but I believe the case came down before the state's brief was even due. So why shouldn't we do that?
I believe that it did come out before the state's brief was due, but I could be wrong on the day.
It was at the omnibus hearing. Okay. Yeah. So I guess the district court has had a chance to address constitutionality.
The district court has had a chance to address the constitutionality.
But not the recent Supreme Court decision.
Not the recent Supreme Court decision.
That's what I was referring. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that there's anything that the district court really needs to address. In fact, I would guess that the way it would go is it would come up to the court on a certified question after the first appearance. So really, in the interest of judicial economy, it really makes sense to just address it now. There's nothing further that needs to be briefed on this case, I don't believe.
And the legislature hasn't had the opportunity to make any changes post AJB, given the release date. I think it was a June decision.
I actually did check the statutes yesterday. There is a change, but I don't know that it
must have been the last legislative session, right. Though. I noticed the same thing.
But, yeah.
Yeah. must okay. be. So what I meant is we don't have legislative activity after the recent Minnesota Supreme Court case.
That's correct. We don't. And any legislative change would not apply to Mr. Peterson's case in any event. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, counsel, Terrence Swihart, Assistant Rice County Attorney, on behalf of respondent, State of Minnesota. In this case, the court is correct that an affirmative waiver of counsel was never given on the record, and a plea on a waiver colloquy never occurred. In this case, however, that does not necessarily mean that the waiver of counsel was not valid. And this court, as it indicated with appellant, looks at the particular facts and circumstances surrounding this case, including the background, experience, and conduct of the accused to determine whether that waiver was valid if there's no express waiver on the record.
Does the court's concern about Peterson's conduct, which led the court to order a Rule 20 evaluation, I mean, does that help or hurt your argument?
Well, I suppose in some circumstances, in some instances, it helps our case because of the argument that his behavior was extremely dilatory throughout the case. But I think ultimately the Rule 20 recommendation that Mr. Peterson was competent to proceed to trial, and within that Rule 20, the findings that Mr. Peterson understood what was happening. And I think the Rule 20 specifically provided that he was able to independently demonstrate an understanding of the concepts, procedures, and how they may otherwise adjudicate his pending charge.
And that's typically that analysis occurs in a Rule 20 to make sure that, in this case, Mr. Peterson was able to help his counsel.
Right? Yes, typically.
Yeah, sort of the focus of the Rule 20.
It is. I mean, it certainly
it's not for self-representation.
No, it isn't, right? You're correct. Yeah. It doesn't indicate, you know, Mr. Peterson understands the costs about representing himself, but it certainly provides some court with some context about what is the level of understanding of Mr. Peterson. I mean, if the Rule 20 eval provided, for example, that Mr. Peterson demonstrated an inability under certain concepts or provided some other language that brought into question Mr. Peterson's ability to really comprehend the judicial system, but yet finding him competent, I think that would be illustrative that he didn't understand exactly, ultimately representing himself, what that would entail.
Well, but the Rule 20 report, as I recall, did discuss in some detail Mr. Peterson's tendency to talk about things that were not at all relevant to the pending charge and you know, how a trial works and what his defenses were. I mean, it seems to me that should have alerted the district court to do more than simply acquiesce, if you will, to Mr. Peterson's statements in the next two hearings that he was representing himself.
Well, I think in some respects the court did question that by saying, are you going to hire private counsel? Mr. Peterson's response was, yes, I'm going to, and I think that happened over roughly two hearings where he said, I'm going to retain private counsel. And with respect to the counsel,
I think what happened over two hearings is he was asked, are you representing yourself, by the court, and Mr. Peterson responds, yes, I am. It's not really the same as alerting the court to an intent to substitute.
You're right. But going back to the prior argument of appellant where Mr. Peterson was represented by an attorney and that representation didn't necessarily mean that he was advised of the cost of representing himself. I think if you look at the record back in August 2017, he ultimately let his attorney go December 5th, 2017, but in August of 2017, he expresses his dissatisfaction with his attorney's representation on the record, but at that time did not ultimately terminate his attorney. So one could assume, I suppose, as we did in the appellate's argument, that between August and December, during that period of representation, his attorney would have identified the cost of representing yourself. If you're not happy with me, you can represent yourself, but here are the cost that should you do that. And then ultimately at the December 5th hearing is when he says, I'm not going to, when he says, fired his attorney saying that he's being relieved of his duties, and the district court then says, you have that right, but you also have the right to retain a private counsel as well. And then subsequent hearings, the four other hearings, where each instance the court inquires if he's representing himself, and he affirms that he is. So I think if you look at these totality of the circumstances where he was represented at least three hearings, and during that period of time, as in the case of, for example, Kretschke, where they and the Worthy and Finney, which I cite in my brief, all three of them are not necessarily directly on point with this case. I mean, it's rarely we have facts. Are you so lucky where you have facts that are directly on point? But those are somewhat analogous in that in each of those cases, they represented themselves. For example, in Worthy, they had an attorney, fired an attorney, had an attorney, and then fired their attorney and argued that, similar to here, that our waiver to representation was violated when the colloquy was never enunciated on the record. The court found that you had you were represented over a month and took full advantage of the representation up to the morning of the trial date.
So, counsel, if I could turn your attention to the case of the welfare of AJB, could you address for us why the reasoning in that case shouldn't cause us to overrule our Hall decision, especially since, as Ms. Martin points out, the Supreme Court did take issue with the mens rea requirement in Subdivision 1.
Right, but ultimately the focus was on Subdivision 1B6, the male, and in that case, in remembering that case, is part of that. The phraseology within the subdivision B6 was any communication, and that's where they, I think, at least in my reading of that statute, they focused on that specific provision and how it was overly broad because it precluded any communication within that provision, and it never did within AJB, never did address Subdivision 2, subpart 4, which is what he was convicted under, Mr. Peterson was convicted under. So while it is correct that AJB did address the stalking statute, it was entirely under a different statute. The reasoning with respect to, I'm sorry, not different statute, but different subpart, it was under subpart 6.
Right, there's no question that AJB addressed a different subpart, but if we compare the two subparts, they're awfully the same. One would be stalking by mail, one would be stalking by telephone.
I think so.
I guess I'm not quite tracking. You seem to be saying there's some difference in the Supreme Court's analysis of the communication.
Unless I read the wrong subpart, I believe the subpart by mail, subpart 6 by mail, within that subpart references any communication. And I could be incorrect. Mm-hmm. If I am, I apologize. And I believe the difference.
Well, I'm looking at the statute as set forth in the AJB opinion, and Subdivision 6 references repeatedly mails or delivers or causes the delivery by any means, including electronically, of letters, telegrams, messages, packages, through assistive devices for people with vision impairments or hearing loss, or any communication made through any available technologies or other objects.
It's that any communication part that I was focusing on that I, mm-hmm. that I remember the Supreme Court was addressing in part of its analysis and how that statute is overly broad. And that similar provision is not within the subpart 4 of this statute.
Well, subpart 4 is all about communications that you make with a telephone. So it's telephone calls and text messages,
right,
correct?
Right.
But it still incorporates subdivisions 1 mens rea mm-hmm. element of knows or has reason to know. And it's still defines the crime with reference to the impact on victims, which ranges from people being afraid to feeling oppressed and intimidated.
Right.
The same broad definition, isn't it?
Yes, and I guess I would go back to the decision in Hall, and that is still the Supreme Court did not entirely find that the entire stalking statute was overly broad, so but still kept it intact, just that finding the subpart 6 was overly broad. So
you think Hall is still good law because the recent case only had to do with subdivision 2-6?
Right, yes. In this case, the totality of the circumstances illustrate that Mr. Peterson did validly waive his right to counsel, and therefore I would request that this court affirm the decision of the conviction. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd just like to briefly address a couple of the points counsel made about the AJB decision. First of all, the discussion about any communication in Subdivision 6, the court analyzed that to explain why the Subdivision 6 is closely tethered to expressive communication. Clearly, we don't have that issue in the stalking by telephone statute because all of the communication by telephone would be closely tethered to expressive activity. And then just to address,
I think the argument that was made in AJB is that because the statute prohibited mailing, it was really focused on conduct, not expression. And as I recall the Supreme Court's analysis, they went on to explain that there is no mailing without content, so that the content was very much a part.
That's correct.
And I'm paraphrasing, but...
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. So the basis for the court's focus on that was to explain why the mail is closely tethered to expressive activity. There's really no question that stalking by telephone would be closely tethered to expressive activity. In fact, probably more closely tethered to expressive activity than mailing would be. And the other point that I wanted to address is the fact that the court did not overturn the entire stalking statute. And that really just reflects the fact that only Subdivision 6 was before it. The court is not going to overturn an entire statute if the entire statute is not before it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. So with that, this matter is submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thanks so much for your arguments and briefs on this matter.
Thank you.